So I bet you can, like, only see me gesturing every time I do the mic check.
Yes, yes, I can see you gesturing, you know. Well, I can hear you, too, but...
Okay, oh, perfect. So I am loud enough.
And hear you. Yes, you are definitely loud enough.
October. Let's get weird.
It is October 15th. It is, you know, like 2 weeks away from Halloween. So, you know, happy Halloween. Also, keep an eye out for that bonus episode we have coming out on the 31st.
Very exciting.
Like we've said before, and like we'll say again in the bonus episode, we talk about a serial killer. It's kind of graphic. So if you don't listen to that episode, we're not going to be upset. But
But if you do, enjoy. But also don't ask us to switch to becoming a, you know, murder podcast.
Oh, yeah. We're not going to become a true crime podcast. No, we're not. But, you know, we're just trying to lead up to that episode with as many trigger warnings as we can.
We know it's weird. We just, you know, we had some scripts we wanted to use. So anyway.
But
we are back for another episode of Conspiracies and Cryptids because that is what we talk about, right?
That is what we talk about to the fullest extent.
That's what we love. We love our jackalopes and our Bigfoot.
Have we ever
decided on what the plural is?
Big feet.
Yeah.
I guess big feet. I don't know.
Wow. Rude. Thanks. Way to call me out.
I don't know. It's just, you know, big feet, I guess. Bigfoots.
Yeah.
Big fi. I don't know.
Big fi. There we go. The big fi.
Like fungi, big fi.
Hey, what are you gonna be for Halloween? Do you know yet?
So for Halloween, I don't really have anything planned for the first time, like, ever. My plan is actually to hand out candy to trick-or-treaters.
Aww.
like I've never gotten to do that. You know, in my entire adult life, I've always either gone to, like, there was like a comic convention in LA that I went to, or I went to Disneyland, or, you know, or I had like a Halloween party for myself and my friends. But it's like, I never really did anything for Halloween, like handing out candy for trick-or-treaters. So this year I've decorated my yard and put up all sorts of, like, you know, traditional spooky things, you know, like hopefully entice this sounds bad. Hopefully entice children to come to my house.
Oh, you wicked witch.
So, you know, but hopefully the decorations show that, hey, I'm participating in Halloween. Come trick or treat my house.
Yay.
So I might wear some kind of a costume. I don't know what, but I'll maybe wear something so that, you know, the kids have, they see that adults wear costumes too.
Exactly.
And then November 2nd, I'm having my Halloween party. So.
Nice.
And that's going to be Harry Potter themed.
Oh, cool. Yep. Cool. Yeah. We don't get very many kids coming through trick-or-treating in our neighborhood. So I'm considering going through and getting a whole bunch of, like, the full-size candy bars because I already know.
That's what, like, I'm going to do.
There's not going to be very many kids. So I'll be like, whatever's left over is mine. And whatever kid comes through, like, have at it, man. So,
yeah. See, I have no idea if there's going to be a lot of kids or not. I just know that I'm going to go buy full-size candy bars and cans of soda. I'm going to be the house that is legendary.
Parents are going to love you. Cool.
Oh, don't worry. I'll also get small little bottles of water and apples for the parents that don't want their kids to have candy.
Oh, look at you thinking ahead.
Oh, also, I'm making sure that none of the candy bars have nuts in them because it seems like every kid has nut allergies these days.
Oh, my gosh. Look at you just thinking ahead. Snickers. You're just getting Snickers at my house. That's all you get. Take it or leave it or it's out. Or, you know,
Snickers and Coke. You get Snickers and Coke. Yeah. That's it. Also, I'm hiding all of my student loan debt in my candy this year. Have you seen that meme going around?
No, that's funny. All right. Well, conspiracies and cryptids are what we talk about, right?
Yes.
So we need to flip a coin.
Flip a penny for our thoughts.
Who picked last time?
I did. So it's your turn.
Okay. So I am shaking it up. And let's go with tails. Because heads seems to usually let me down. So. Ah, tails.
There you go.
Cool.
I am buckled in and ready to go.
Oh, All right. Well, this one will be kind of interesting. We get to kind of chit chat about this one. So you guys may remember that last episode I talked about people who seem to appear out of thin air. And we discussed Otsuro Bune, which is the ancient story of a woman washing ashore in Japan, unable to speak the language, in a strange vessel resembling like an incense burner or a pot of rice.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, I remember.
Markings on that vessel are said to be similar to those found at the Rendlesham Forest incident, which took place took Alice into like a new rabbit hole. I mean, like, holy cow. So in late December of 1980, there were a series of sightings of unexplained lights near Rendlesham Forest in Suffolk, London, which have been linked with claims of UFO landings in the area.
Mm-hmm.
USAF personnel, including the deputy base commander, all claimed to see things that they described as a UFO. This is considered the most famous of claimed UFO events to have happened in the UK, and it's often referred to as Britain's Roswell.
Right.
The UK Ministry of Defense stated it's like without an official investigation that the event posed no threat to national security and therefore never actually investigated this as a security matter. So okay. They were like, nah, it's fine. You know, don't
this
worry
is
about
fine,
it.
Guys. We're fine.
This is fine, which means they totally knew something. And they were like, you know,
nah. We're just going to sweep this under the rug.
Exactly. They're like, you guys don't get to talk about it. Like, we get to know, but don't worry about it.
Don't worry about it. Okay.
So, as usual, let's kind of get our bearings. It's on the southeast side of the UK. The Rendlesham Forest is owned by the Forestry Commission and consists of about 5.8 square miles of coniferous plants interspersed with heathland and wetland areas. So okay. It's got a pretty good mix of life happening in there.
Mm-hmm.
It's in Suffolk County, about 8 miles east of Ipswich. Rendlesham is technically near two Air Force bases, RAF Woodbridge and RAF Bendwaters, which is just to the north of the forest.
Right.
At the time, they were both being used by the United States Air Force and were under command of Wing Commander General Colonel Gordon E. Williams.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's Base Commander Colonel Ted Conrad and his Deputy Lieutenant Colonel Charles Halt, who we're going to talk about a lot.
Okay. So, fun fact.
Yes.
My dad was stationed at RAF Bentwaters.
Ooh, cool.
From like 1987 or 88 until like 1990 something. So I lived on RAF Bentwaters until I was about 4 years old. And my brother was born there. And you know, my dad was actually, cause you mentioned this in the last episode. So my dad was actually really excited that you're going to talk about this because he got stationed there just like a couple of years after this happened and everybody was still talking about it. It was still a big topic of discussion because it was just so important.
Yeah. So, I mean, it only happened in like December of 1980. So this is like really recent considering a lot of the things we talk about.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
In fact, I've got some actual direct quotes from people.
There we go.
I know. So, exciting. But first we'll talk about what actually happened. So the day after Christmas, December 26th of 1980, early in the morning, a security patrol near the east gate of RAF Woodbridge reportedly saw lights descending into the nearby Rendlesham Forest. Servicemen initially thought it was a downed aircraft, but upon entering the forest to investigate, they found a glowing object, metallic in appearance, with colored lights. It was like this weird triangular, like kind of ship thing that was just hanging out there with like a tripod.
Mm.
When they made a move to approach it, it appeared to move through the trees, sending all the wildlife nearby into a frenzy.
Ugh. I hate having my wildlife frenzied.
I know. Gosh, so disturbing. Leave them alone. So the servicemen followed it for a while until it reached a field and then suddenly shot upwards, shining a brilliant light down on them and then disappearing. Mm. They lost consciousness, and when they came to again, they were back in the forest.
Oh, gross.
So it's like, what happened? Okay. Local police were called out to investigate, but by the time they got there, they said the only lights that they could find were coming from a nearby lighthouse some miles away on the coast.
Mm-hmm.
Once day broke, the servicemen returned to the place that they found the UFO, but all that was left there were a set of three small impressions on the ground in a triangular pattern, as well as some burn marks and broken branches on nearby trees. In fact, I've got some pictures that were taken, because remember, this was recent, so I've got some. So see here, there's like this guy here, this part here, and then there's supposed to be like another one over here, and it's like, like, look at these burn marks. But it's like, oh, okay, that kind of also looks like a just an indentation in the
Oh, that's really neat ground. Looking.
Yeah. So.
Huh. Okay.
Now, so the police were called out again to check those out, but they said, eh, animals, you know.
Eh, animals.
It could be. I mean.
I guess. I guess animals could leave, you know, perfect circle burn marks in the ground. You know, that sounds like the total sort of thing an animal could do.
Exactly. So Georgina Bruni published a photograph of the supposed landing site taken the morning after the first sighting in her book, You Can't Tell the People. And that's the picture I just showed you.
Right.
It was during this investigation that another flashing light was spotted across the field to the east, almost in line with a farmhouse, as the witnesses had first seen a few days before. So they're kind of starting to go, ah, could it have been that farmhouse in the distance? Maybe. Okay,
maybe. Hmm.
2 days later, the deputy base commander, Lieutenant Colonel Charles Hault, visited the site with several service members for radiation readings in the Triangle of Depressions. They found a spike of radiation near the depressions and some background radiation nearby, and then another burst a half mile from the landing site.
Okay.
There were also three star-like lights that were seen in the sky, two to the north and one to the south, about 10 degrees above the horizon. Hault said the brightest of those hovered for about 2 to 3 hours and then seemed to beam down a stream of light from time to time.
Ooh.
Yeah.
That's so weird. Okay.
There's like these strange kind of like lights and different corners of the like, oh, that's. And then it would just kind of stream down like little spotlights.
Little
and
like just little tractor beam sort of thing.
Beam me up, Scotty.
Interesting.
A smaller group of the men on a separate trek on the forest found a dancing red light and an eerie pulsating fog around it. Can you like how can a fog pulsate? Like,
I mean, I guess maybe light weird. Inside it was pulsating.
Maybe.
I don't know. That could make it look like it's pulsating. I don't know.
So they alerted Halt's group, who saw the lights heading toward them, and that were shining a rainbow waterfall of colors toward them. So they're like the same lights were directed toward Halt's group, but it was not red now. It was this like weird rainbow of colors. But the other group still saw the red. Meanwhile, the second group that was watching the glowing, like, red now saw a domed object in which they could see the shadows of figures moving inside.
They're seeing the aliens inside their cockpit.
Exactly. And this is, like, an amalgamation of a bunch of different accounts that, like, people have kind of pieced together to find this whole. So if it doesn't match, like, some other, like, versions of the story you've heard, it's because there are so many different versions of the story.
Oh boy. So yeah. A lot of people saw it then.
I mean, there was a pretty big group of these guys that were walking around in the forest looking for this thing. So either they were all coming up with like really fun stories going, you know, it'd be fun if we add, you know, add this. And, you know, it'd be fun if we add this.
But that would take a lot of coordination.
You never
coordinate a bunch of different
stories.
Everyone's
story's different.
Yeah.
Clearly they didn't coordinate very well.
Yeah, well, apparently.
There is alleged photo and video evidence of both encounters, despite official denial, though. So they're like, it is out there.
Okay.
Let's talk about some of that evidence.
The first piece
of primary evidence to be made available to the public under the Freedom of Information Act in 1983 was a memorandum written by the deputy base commander, Lieutenant Colonel Charles I. Hault, to the Ministry of Defense, known as the Hault Memo.
Mm-hmm.
It's dated January 13th, 1981, under the title Unexplained Lights. That's 2 weeks after this allegedly occurred. And the delay in reporting is the apparent excuse for some of the errors in dates and times, because apparently some of the times that he reported don't, like, match up with what some of the other guys said. But for some reason, they kind of hold what the other guys say as like kind of the consensus, and this guy is like, he kind of got his dates wrong, but what he said is basically right.
Interesting.
The Ministry of Defense also says that there are no other reports to be found on this matter and no other evidence calling Hault a crackpot, basically, and Hault thinks he witnessed an extraterrestrial event that was then covered up. Because they're like, yeah, this guy says it, but we don't know anything else about this. But then there was a huge file that was then released on this. And it was like, there's more information on this than you said.
Oh, so they were like withholding a lot of information then.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's sneaky. Okay.
In 1984, a copy of what became known as the Halt Tape was released to UFO researchers by Colonel Sam Morgan, who had succeeded Ted Conrad as Halt's superior. The boss turned this in to the UFO police. Like,
ooh.
Yeah, he handed UFO over. Police. Yes, I've called the UFO research the UFO police. Here you go. You're the authorities on the matter. The tape allegedly chronicles Halt's entire investigation in the forest in real time, including taking radiation readings to the like the sighting of the flashing red light between the trees and the star-like objects that hovered and twinkled in the distance. And I listened to part of it. It's like I couldn't get it downloaded, so I can't really show you guys, but. It's pretty easily found online, and they actually go through and they're like, yeah, our lights don't work, so we're just going to kind of check for some radiation over in this area while we wait for this new light to come in, and we're just going to kind of hang out over here. And then they start reporting the lights in the distance, and they're kind of unsettled by it. Like, they're not, like, freaked out, but they're...
But they're just uncomfortable?
Yeah, just kind of not really sure about it, so... But it's got the whole investigation on there. So there are some direct quotes that came out of this afterward and other interviews from some of the guys that were involved. So from one from Sergeant James Peniston.
Okay.
In an interview with ABC, quote, "What I once believed is no more, and what I've witnessed defies all that I have ever imagined. I am truly in awe over the whole incident, and no one can truly or can fully understand the magnitude of such an event unless you were there." Clearly, since none of you guys can get your story straight.
Then,
Sergeant Bud Steffens, who spotted the strange lights on the 25th and 26th, said it didn't crash, it landed.
Okay, so he was like, no, this is not a crash. This purposefully came down and landed, and we saw it.
Very controlled, like, it was not, and it took back off again. It was like, this was on purpose. This wasn't an accident.
They knew what they were doing, sort of thing.
And even this quote from the disaster preparedness technician, Sergeant Montreux Nevels, said there were three objects or lights. The largest light was the leading or command vessel. The lights were three vessels that moved independently of each other. They were moving and were able to jump from Woodbridge and then show up over Brent Waters in less than a second. So the thing could move super fast, too. And
yeah,
they were
that
like,
is really quick.
Pew!
Huh.
So obviously there's a lot of skepticism around this. All of this sounds like an awesome story to tell around the Halloween candy bowl this month, but we're healthy skeptics here.
Yes.
In 1997.
Somewhat healthy.
Somewhat. We're skeptics.
We're just skeptics.
In 1997, Scottish researcher James Easton obtained the original witness statements made by those involved in the first night sightings. Ed Cabansang said in his statement, "We figured the lights were coming from past the forest, since nothing was visible when we passed through the woody forest. We could see a glowing glowing near the beacon light, but as we got closer, we found it to be a lit up farmhouse. We got to a vantage point where we could determine that what we were chasing was only a second or was only a beacon of light off in the distance." So they were like, yeah, it's just a farmhouse.
Okay.
Another guy said, John Burroughs said, also stated, "We could see a beacon going around, so we went towards it. We followed it about 2 miles before we could see it was coming from a lighthouse," which I'm also going to talk about in a sec. Okay. But Burroughs also reported a noise like a woman screaming, but that you could hear farm animals making a ruckus nearby. Halt reported the same noises 2 nights later, but such noise could have been made by a Muntjac deer in the forest, which are known for their loud, shrill bark when they're startled.
Yeah. So if you've ever heard a moose cry, it's creepy sounding.
Really creepy. Yeah, that like weird like whistle. Like
Yeah, it's really weird sounding. Like you would think looking at a moose that it makes like this low grunting growl sort of thing, but no, it makes this like high pitched like wailing.
Almost like an elk-ish.
Yeah, kind of like an elk do it too. Yeah, it's really a creepy sound.
There's also the possibility it could have been a fireball. The initial sighting at 3 a.m. on December 26th coincides with the appearance of a bright fireball over southern England. And the landing marks have been explained away by like rabbit diggings. They were like, it's just rabbits. Like they said, they keep saying they're animals.
Yeah. And like I said, I don't think a rabbit can, you know, burrow a perfect circle like that.
You know, exactly. There's also bright stars that it's been blamed on. Maybe they need to brush up on their astronomy. Like maybe there was a new star or like something was a little brighter right there. Who knows? It was the 80s. So maybe light pollution kind of, you know, who knows?
Maybe.
Maybe they were brushing up on their astrology and they were like, you know, I'm feeling a little Gemini today.
Mercury is in retrograde.
Yes. there's also, like I said, there was a lighthouse nearby. The Orfordness Lighthouse is along the same line of sight, about 5 miles further east of the forest edge. At the time, it was one of the brightest lighthouses in the UK, and it was built in 1792. But since this was a scrappy band of American Air Force servicemen, they may not have been used to seeing such a sight in the distance. Maybe they were
possibly
like new, and they were like, that's really bright. What is that? But it was one of the brightest things in the area at the time.
Interesting. Okay. That is interesting.
The BBC also reported a former U.S. security policeman, Kevin Condy, claimed the responsibility for creating the strange lights in the forest by driving around a police vehicle whose lights he had modified. But there's actually no evidence that actually happened. They're like, well, where's the car? And he's like, I got rid of it. Like, but where is it?
Sure.
So, you know, they also claim that it could be a downed Soviet spy satellite with no evidence to prove this either.
Mm, right. Yeah.
They can't find it unless somebody swooped in and got rid of it.
Right. Now, I mean, that was during the Soviet Union. So maybe, but there was a lot of Soviet panic, too. So maybe not.
Exactly.
But, okay.
So the story kind of continues because Holt won't give it up.
Right,
first,
of course.
In 2005, so I mentioned that there was some writing too. They found writing on the ship. One of the reports said that. And then in 2005, the Forestry Commission used lottery money to create a trail in the Rendlesham Forest because of the public interest and nicknamed the UFO trail. In 2014, the Forestry Service commissioned an artist to create a work that has been installed at the end of the trail, which is rumored to be modeled after what was reported there. So I'll show you this. This is the couple that made it. And they're so proud. So see, it's this weird. And then this is the tripod underneath here. And then there's writing on the back that they claim was an artistic representation of what could have been found. It looks kind of like something you would see to like push to get into like some fancy section in like a Nickelodeon. Like, let's see. Give me 1 second here.
I don't know what you're trying to say.
Hang on.
It looks interesting, though. It definitely looks UFO-ish.
It's like this, like, weird, like, splatter symbol around it.
You're talking about the symbol, what the symbol looks like. Oh, okay.
So, see, it's like this, like, weird, drippy, like.
Oh, it kind of looks
like this,
like,
weird writing.
Like a drippy handprint sort of thing.
So Olivia English, who created it, said that the symbols on the model were no secret code. It's art. But I mean, there hasn't been a whole lot of interpretation of what the symbols on the ship said. They talk more about the lights.
Okay, right.
But since there have been so many reports that are so different, like some talk about symbols, some don't.
Right.
But in June of 2010, Holt was still fighting for his insanity in the headlines, or his sanity, excuse me. He's retired, but he signed a notarized affidavit in which he summarized what had happened, and he stated that the event was extraterrestrial in nature and accused the UK and the US of a grand cover-up. But the contradictions between his summary and the original report have been pointed out. Okay. In fact, there were even discrepancies between the affidavit and his original report. So,
oh, really?
It's like, make up your mind, man. Like, what happened? And now we're getting so far away that it's kind of his credibility is getting less and less.
Time goes on, the less likely his story is going to be taken as true.
Exactly. Then later in 2010, the old boss, Colonel Ted Conrad, provided a statement about the incident. He said, "We saw nothing that resembled Holt's descriptions either in the sky or on the ground," and quote, "that we had people in position to validate Halt's narrative, but none of them could. He also berated Halt for continuing the charade and mentioned Sergeant Jim Peniston, who claimed to have touched an alien spacecraft. He said that when he spoke to him at the time of the incident, he didn't say anything about this, and Conrad suggested that the whole thing was a hoax. So allegedly this Peniston guy had, like, and like I said, there was even an interview with him on ABC saying, I, like, everything I knew just goes out the window. I have this whole new, like, experience. But then Conrad claims he talked to him and he was like, he didn't say anything at the time. I don't know what he's talking about now.
Interesting.
Isn't that kind of strange?
Yeah.
So then, but in 1983, there was an article that reported, quote, Colonel Ted Conrad, the base commander, recalls five Air Force policemen spotted lights from what they thought was a small plane descending into the forest. Two of the men tracked the object and on foot and came upon a large tripod-mounted craft. Mm-hmm. It had no windows, but was studded with brilliant red and blue lights. Each of the men came within 50 yards of the ship, Conrad relates. It levitated 6 feet in the air and backed away. They followed it for almost an hour through the woods and crossed a field until it took off at a phenomenal speed. Acting on the reports made by his men, Colonel Conrad began a brief investigation of the incident in the morning. He went into the forest and located a triangular pattern, ostensibly made by the tripod legs. He did interview two of the witnesses and concludes, those lads saw something, but I don't know what it was. So in 1983,
he seemed to
have more of an opinion that was like, yeah, sure. Okay, kids, like, if you saw what you saw. At one time, he was on board. And was like,
but then he probably got yelled at by his superiors and was told, you're not on board. And he was exactly. like, I'm not on board.
Exactly. So, so you believed it one time, Conrad.
We see
so that's
you.
What I have to say about the Rendlesham Forest incident.
Oh, that's so interesting. I love UFOs, like everything UFO related. It's just, you know, I've said it before. I'll say it again. It's my favorite sort of conspiracy, and I just love them, and they're great.
Yeah, it was a neat thing to investigate this month. It was kind of quite cool.
Yeah, no, and I'm gonna have to talk to my dad some more about like what he knows about it as well. Just especially being somebody who was there not long after it happened. You know,
yeah.
I mean, I don't know if he knew any of the people that were involved. Probably not, but you never know. I'll ask
him.
I'll ask him, and we'll find out.
That'd be great. But, so we're going to take a break. And when we get back, Sammy's got a cryptid for us.
I sure do. So we'll talk to you in a sec. All right. So we're back. And I'm going to talk about my cryptid. I picked this one because I felt like since we're leading up to Halloween, it was good to pick something kind of classic horror cryptid sort of thing. Also, this does slightly tie in with our Halloween bonus episode.
Ooh.
Just FYI.
Ooh.
So, yeah. So, whether they're giving interviews about their centuries-long lives, causing drama over a synthetic blood substitute, or sparkling their way into the hearts of teenage girls, there's no question that vampires have been quite the center of supernatural media attention over the past decade.
Yay, we're doing vampires!
We are doing
Yay!
Vampires.
I love it.
But the legend of vampires actually extends back centuries and permeates just about every culture on the planet. So, how is this a cryptid? Well, despite the fact that we've pretty much chalked them up to works of fiction at this point, there have been actual documented sightings and cases of vampires throughout history. And the fact that they are in every culture kind of makes them a little bit less of a folklore tale and more of a cryptid, because it wasn't like just one area and one specific country made them up and they kind of became everywhere. It was like, no, they've just kind of existed in every country's lore. And it wasn't until centuries later that we kind of realized, hey, these all are kind of the same thing. Where'd they come from? So today's version of vampires, as we know them, originated in the 19th century with the publication of John Polidori's The Vampire in 1819. And that's spelled V-A-M-P-Y-R-E. And it was popularized with the famous Dracula by Bram Stoker in 1897. This version of the vampire is the one we're most familiar with even now. But the actual concept of vampires or vampire-like entities existed for millennia, With the list of vampires in folklore on Wikipedia containing 266 entries from all over the world.
Wow.
So, yeah. And that's not just like characters. I'm talking like that's like demons, entities, people, folklore tales all throughout history. 266 entries of vampire-like creatures.
Wow.
Some of these entries include the Striga of Albania, the Vrykolakas of Greece, the Strigoi of Romania, and the Jiangshi of China, and even the Chupacabra from Central America, which we will talk about at some point on this podcast, I promise. I've had a lot of people ask me to talk about the Chupacabra. I promise it's coming, you guys. I just haven't gotten to it yet. I try not to cover a lot of big name cryptids in one season so that I don't run out of topics.
Exactly. We want to tell you guys about stuff you don't already know about.
Exactly. So, however, most of these creatures or entities are considered precursors to the modern vampire, with much of the lore we're familiar with coming from Southeastern Europe, which is places like Albania, Romania, the Ukraine, stuff like that. So, we've got two kinds of descriptions for vampires. We've got the pre-19th century vampires and the post-19th century vampires. So pre-19th century, which is pre-1800s for people who are century disabled like I am, they were bloated. They were ruddy or purplish in skin tone. They had blood seeping from their mouth and nose. They were dressed in a burial shroud. And they had teeth, hair, and their teeth, hair, and nails had grown since burial, but they didn't have fangs. So they basically just kind of looked like a bloated corpse.
Ew.
You know, that had like blood on its face. Hmm. And it was literally dressed, because back then they used to bury people not just in clothes, but a shroud that covered them as well. Mm-hmm. So they also had that shroud over them. And mm-hmm. a shroud was kind of like, kind of a see-through sort of cloth covering, kind of like gossamer or something like that, that you would just cover them with. So they were covered in that still. And then post 19th century vampires, which is like after the books that I mentioned, they were immortal. They had fangs. They were harmed by sunlight. They are also harmed by garlic. They're very glamorous and beautiful, and they're very gaunt and pale. So very, very different descriptions of what vampires are.
Very much so. Yeah.
Okay. So now we're going to get into sightings. And as far as sightings go, I'm going to go more with famous people and cases throughout history that have been chalked up to vampirism. So the very first one that we're going to talk about is one of the most notorious vampires in history. And it's none other than Vlad the Third Dracul, otherwise known as Vlad the Impaler or Dracula. So, and he was from Romania.
Yep. I know that story.
Yes. A lot of people do. Like I said, it's very famous. So, in ancient Romanian, Dracul was a title given to Vlad's father, Vlad II, when he entered the Order of the Dragon. And it literally translates to Vlad the Dragon. He was called Vlad Dracul, or Vlad II Dracul. So Vlad the Dragon. And Dracula translates to son of the dragon. So Vlad. Yeah. So Vlad the Third is he was called Dracula, which translates to son of the dragon, which was Vlad the Second. So
interesting.
I thought that was really cool. However, in modern Romanian, Dracul translates to the devil, which might attribute part to the legend, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's just over the centuries and years of languages evolving and translating, Dracul has gone from being dragon to also meaning devil. So Dracula would mean son of the devil or something like that.
I see.
So Vlad the Third or Vlad the Impaler was known for his cruelty during his many reigns over the region of Wallachia, which bordered Transylvania. He actually had three separate rules because there were a bunch of different wars that happened, and he would lose his place and then get it back, or he'd get taken captive and then be released and rule again. So, yeah, he had three separate reigns.
You got lots of options when the people aren't voting for you. You know, you can just kind of take it if you want it.
Yes. Yeah. And he definitely did. Mm-hmm. In fact, his third rule was where he actually lived in Transylvania and had a castle there, which is the famous one that we know of today. But he didn't live there for the majority of his life. He lived in Wallachia. So during his war, or let's see, his favorite method of execution was obviously impalement. That was what he did to pretty much anybody who opposed him. He liked to impale them on stakes, which is how he got his name, Vlad the Impaler.
Like, what's your favorite pastime? Oh, you know, I just go out, you know, impaling.
Have you seen like this meme of Vlad the Impaler discovers marshmallows and like he goes to roast them and he sticks it on like a stick and goes, well, these are freaking great.
That's funny. I bet he loves kebabs too.
Right. Anyway, so during his war with the Saxons of Transylvania, his tyrannical rule and cruelty caused the Saxons to write political propaganda and stories about him that not only did he impale his enemies, but that he also consumed their blood. These stories made it to Germany, where they were highly propagated and made him into the vampire we know him as today. However, whether or not Vlad actually did any of this is completely unclear. We don't know, but it's possible. Also, the story of Dracula, while it wasn't completely based on Vlad the Impaler, some elements were taken from history to inspire Dracula.
Of course. Interesting. Yeah. Interesting. How amazing how you can not only color fiction with nonfiction, but also
fiction can color nonfiction,
you know, have, you know, the way stories evolve over centuries and just in this case, but, you know, how many stories across the board, you know?
Right. And a lot of it, you know, like I said, was political propaganda, you know, that they used that to tarnish his image. Not that he really needed the help.
No.
You know, he was very well known for being a cruel tyrant, but, you know, they helped it nonetheless. So. Mm-hmm. It's possible he drank the blood of his enemies. It's possible he didn't, but we don't really know. Another famous vampire from the same general region, and this is one of my favorites, who I learned about. Well, I didn't learn about this person in college, but I learned about this person while I was in college, if that makes sense. So I didn't learn about them from like a class. It was just while I was in college, I did some research on this person. This woman is the Countess Elizabeth or Ursabet Bathory, otherwise known as the Blood Countess. Yes, she is labeled by the Guinness Book of World Records as the most prolific female serial killer of all time. And she is attributed upwards of 650 women, murders of young women to her by some accounts, though the exact number is uncertain. So according to the Guinness Book of World Records, her number of kills is anywhere from 650 or down.
Wow.
So up to 650 young girls.
Wow. Holy cow.
Right? Yes. So, her brutal and sadistic killings were not only verified in the testimonies of over 300 witnesses and survivors, but were also evidenced with the findings of the mutilated, dead, dying, and imprisoned girls at the time of her arrest. So this is very well documented.
Yeah.
This happened. Like there were 300 witnesses said, we saw this or I survived this. And then when they went to arrest her, they found evidence of bodies, and
they were like, you still got girls in cages.
Yes.
They're waiting to be slaughtered. Like, holy cow. Yeah. Lady, like, cover your trail better. Jesus.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Yeah,
it was bad. Okay, so Elizabeth started her killings with servant girls between the ages of 10 and 14 years old before moving on. So they were her own servants. You know, they were the children of her own servants before she moved on to local peasant girls who were lured to the castle with the promise of work. So she basically said, not just her, but like her and her servants and workers were like, oh, come to the castle and you can be a servant girl to the countess, you know, which was a big deal, you know, and probably the families at the time of those peasant girls were like, yes, go do this. You'll make our family money.
You got an amazing job. Go, go, go.
Yes.
And then they're never coming back,
and they
nor
never
get any money.
And they were never seen or heard from again.
Oh my God. Cruel.
After she ran out of peasant girls, Elizabeth opened a sort of etiquette or finishing school for the girls of the lower gentry and killed many of them as well. So she opened like, you know, an etiquette school for girls, you know, which was a very popular thing at the time. And especially for the lower gentry, oh, this is our chance to touch elbows with the finest, you know. Mm-hmm. And then they were never seen or heard from again. But that was kind of what started to tip people off. Like, when servant girls and peasants go missing in this day and age, people don't really say anything or don't really notice or don't really care, you know, because of the class system that existed back then. But when the lower gentry start going missing, that's when people start saying something's fishy going on at the castle, you know, something mm-hmm. wicked this way comes. Mm-hmm. So that's when she got caught and she eventually got arrested. But by that time, she had already killed about 650 people. Now, granted, not necessarily all of those murders were her specifically. They may have been some of her chambermaids or people working directly with her. But since she was in charge, she was kind of the mob boss of this whole thing going on. They're technically considered her murders, even if she didn't directly commit them.
Yeah, yeah.
So what led to Elizabeth being marked as a vampire were that some of the torture that she did to girls include biting on various body parts, as well as rumors that she bathed in the blood of her victims in order to maintain her beauty. Though that rumor has never been proven as either true or false. And it is also widely speculated that Elizabeth did, in fact, cannibalize some of her victims. Ooh. So, you know, so she did torture them in many different ways. But one of the ways that she tortured them was biting them, you know, on Ooh. All parts of the body. So, yeah, it was, you know, very commonly thought that she was a vampire
yeah.
because of all the different ways that she tortured.
Ooh.
Yeah, absolutely Ooh. Terrifying. The next couple of, like, sightings, quote unquote sightings that we're going to get into they're not serial killers or horrific things like that. They're more just unexplained cases or maybe even explained cases that are kind of chalked up to vampirism. So this next case is about Petar Blagojevic, who was a Serbian peasant living in what is now Kiseljevo. Upon his death in 1725 from the plague, which I didn't know this because when you think of the plague, you think of England and Europe mm-hmm. suffering from the plague in the 1300s,
yeah, yeah.
not the 1700s in mm-hmm. Serbia,
yeah,
no. which is, you know, like 400 years later,
mm-hmm. which even people today still get the plague. But
oh, yeah, the plague yeah. is still around and still happens. But oh, yeah. There was an outbreak of the plague.
Wow.
In this area mm-hmm. of the world mm-hmm. in the 1700s, mm-hmm. which I didn't
wow.
know about.
No.
Because you only hear about the Black Plague. In yeah. in Europe. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so it was rampant in this southeastern part of Europe in the 1700s. So upon his death in 1725 from the plague, he was blamed for the deaths of 9 fellow townsfolk over the following 8 subsequent days. On their deathbeds, they all claimed that they had been throttled by him during the night. Even his wife claimed that he had visited her after his death asking for his shoes.
Oh, have you seen my shoes?
I guess,
honey.
I guess he'd been buried without them. I don't know.
Honey, where are my shoes?
Yeah. And then she moved to another town not long after for safety reasons.
Yeah.
So she was like, nope, I'm done.
I don't know how to give a ghost shoes, so I might as well move.
I feel like that's quickly becoming one of my catchphrases is nope, I'm done.
Nope, I'm done.
I think I've said it in like the last 3 episodes and I'm just realizing it. Nope, I'm done.
Nope.
So townsfolk demanded that Cameral Provisor Frombold, and I looked up that word and I can't find any sort of definition for what Cameral Provisor means. I thought maybe it meant mayor or something, but there is, like, I Google searched that word, and all that came up was this story.
Weird.
On, like, a bunch of different websites. So I have no idea what it means. So if there's anybody listening from Serbia who speaks English, and obviously you'd need mm-hmm. to listen to us, or if you know anything about Serbian mm-hmm. culture or the language, and you could tell us what Cameral Provisor means, please let me know, because like I said, I could not find anything.
Please do.
So they asked, or they demanded that Cameral Provisor Frumbold and a priest should exhume Petar's body and check for signs of vampirism, which included growth of hair growth of hair, beard, and nails, as well as lack of decomposition. Frombold initially protested, stating that they should wait for permission from the authorities in Belgrade, but the townsfolk insisted, fearing that by the time they got permission, it would be too late and the entire town would fall victim to the plague.
Oh.
By Petar.
Hmm.
Upon exhumation of his body, the signs of vampirism were in fact present, and the entire town became terrified and outraged. They were, in fact, one quote actually said that they were more outraged than terrified. They were mad that he was a vampire. I guess. I don't know. But like, yeah, they were terrified and outraged. You? How dare you?
How dare you?
The gall.
How dare
the
you?
Nerve.
I'd like to speak to your manager.
A vampire manager. I'd like to speak to your vampire manager. So they staked the body through the heart, which caused fresh blood to pour from the ear, nose, and mouth of the corpse. Ultimately, the body was burned.
Ooh.
So they staked and then burned it.
They're like, mm-mm.
Yeah. The next story is about Arnold Paoli, who was a hajduk, or peasant infantryman. So hajduk was like a Serbian word for peasant infantryman.
Okay.
So he was in the army as an infantryman, but he was just a peasant.
Like lowest rank. Like
a lot of times they would send the peasantry out. Like this is just in military history in general. The peasants would be the front lines,
mm-hmm.
you know, because
the pawns.
As I said before, the class systems that existed at the times, peasants were worthless mm-hmm. and replaceable. So yeah, they would send them to the front lines and they would be the infantrymen. So he was a hajduk. And he was living in the town of Medveda in Serbia. He often complained about the fact that he had been plagued by a vampire while he was out in serving in the war in what is modern day Kosovo, but that he'd cured himself by ingesting soil from the grave of the vampire and smearing himself with its blood. So he'd been bitten and was going to turn. But what he did was to stop himself from turning into a vampire as well. He ate soil from the vampire's grave and then got some of the vampire's blood, I guess, and smeared it on his face.
Oh, bro. Smart thinking. Yes. I'm going to eat dirt and
eat
then
dirt.
Smear blood all over myself and we'll see what happens. And hey, what do you know? It worked.
Maybe recipe.
Maybe he's born with it. Maybe it's Maybelline.
Maybe he's born with it. Maybe it's vampirism.
Vampirism, you know.
So Arnold died in 1725, which was the same year as Petar, ironically, from a fall off of a hay wagon where he broke his neck. So he didn't die from the plague or vampirism. He fell off a wagon and broke his neck.
Not immortal.
No, definitely
also
not.
Also probably not a bright one.
No, definitely not. But within a month, four people claimed that they had been plagued by him and subsequently died shortly thereafter.
Oh.
So, within the span of a month after he died, four people claimed he's visited me, he's tormented me, he's given me the plague, and then they died.
Oh my gosh, way to, like, blame other people for your problems there, guys.
I mean, right? When I was doing this research, I was very much reminded of, like, the Salem witch trials, mm-hmm. where it was like, you know, oh, Goody Pope has, you know, plagued me in the night. Goody Pope has made me dance with the devil, you know? So yeah.
It's
very human nature to blame other people for your problems.
Oh my God. I cheated on my wife. It must've been, you know, Goody Pope put a hex on me and told me to do it. Like, no, you cheated.
Well, I mean, even the whole concept of a temptress is very like putting the blame on the woman.
Exactly.
Oh, she was dressed very tempting. That made me cheat on her. I slipped.
Oh, see, okay. This is just early version of the movement.
So 10 days later, townsfolk pleaded with local military administrator that they open Arnold's grave to look for signs of vampirism. Once they opened his grave, accounts stated that his veins were still contained fluid blood and that fresh blood flowed from his eyes, nose, mouth, and ears. It was also noted that his shirt, the covering, and the coffin were completely bloody, and that the old nails on his hands and feet, along with the skin, had fallen off and that new ones had grown in.
Ew.
Gross,
new?
Right?
Oh. Fresh set. Check it.
Check out the French tips in the fresh set. At this point, they drove a stake through his heart, which was customary at the time, to which he reportedly shrieked in pain and groaned and began bleeding. They then decapitated and burnt the body, then did the same to all four of his victims, lest they become vampires as well. Right?
Just in case.
Other things that were popular at the time to prevent vampires was they would stick a brick in the mouth of the corpse or of the dead body. They would like wrench the jaw open and stick a brick in there so that they couldn't bite anybody. I know there are actually archaeologists and stuff have found skeletons with a brick wedged in the mouth. And that was what it was, you know, they were trying to prevent vampirism.
Ew,
it's really interesting.
Thinking about that. Oh, my God.
Yeah, I know. So the next one comes from New England during the 1800s, which was right in the middle of their vampire panic. This vampire panic was mainly caused by a tuberculosis outbreak, which tuberculosis was known at the time as consumption, because it seemingly consumed the people from the inside out. This is the case of Mercy Brown, and it is one of the most well-known and well-documented cases of vampirism. The case took place in Exeter, Rhode Island, and is a depressing story of how tuberculosis, known at the time as consumption, completely devastated the Brown family. Since not a lot was known about tuberculosis at the time, a lot of it was fed or left up to superstition and speculation, with one of the main superstitions being that multiple deaths in one family was due to undead activity from a previously deceased family member. So basically, they believed that, you know, when somebody came down with this disease and died from it, and then subsequent members of the family also caught it, the first person to die from it, or one of the people in the family to die from it, was kind of sucking the life force out of their family members from beyond the grave. Now, they weren't necessarily leaving their coffins like traditional vampires that we think of, but they were just the body itself, the dead body was seemingly undead and was sucking the life out of family members in order to come back to life at a later time. So that was at least the superstition.
If you're a fan of fiction and Stephen King and you've read Salem's Lot, it's like all centered around that concept of a vampire and around that specific storytelling of that like version. And that's one of my favorite takes on the vampire curse is that book. That's one of and it's one of the first ones he wrote. Yeah.
Yeah, it's such an interesting concept, and it's really interesting how that superstition just completely pervaded the entire region at the time. You know, because I mean that tuberculosis outbreak in that time or the 1800s was massive. Everybody was getting it, you know. But so Mary Brown, the matriarch of the family, was the first to die. And she was followed shortly after by her eldest daughter, also named Mary. And then 5 years later, their daughter, Mercy, also died. And then their son, Edwin, contracted the disease. So within 5 or 6 years, three family members had died and a fourth member had contracted the disease. Oof. So that's a lot of people really quickly. It was at this time that the townsfolk persuaded George Brown, the father, to exhume the bodies of Mary, and Mercy in order to investigate the cause of their family's plight. On March 17th, 1892, the bodies of Mary, and Mercy were... That sounds like a band name, Mary, and Mercy.
Mary, and Mercy.
Or like a TV show. So on March 17th, 1892, the bodies of Mary, and Mercy were exhumed, which was 1 year after Mercy's death. Both Marys were found to be decomposing as expected and were pardoned from being the cause of Edwin's illness. Mercy, however, exhibited hardly any signs of decomposition and even still had blood in her heart, which everyone took to mean she was feeding on Edwin's life from beyond the grave. Reports had also been made that people had seen her wandering around town at night. Per superstition, Mercy's heart and liver were removed and burned, and the ashes were mixed into a glass of water to be drank by Edwin to cure his tuberculosis and stop the undead influence, which, like I said, that was customary. You know, they burned the heart, and liver. And then, yeah, they swished it around in water and said, here, sick person, drink this.
Drink
this will cure your disease.
Try this.
It's so gross.
Delicious.
Ugh, botulism soup.
Mm.
Edwin died 2 months later, however.
Yeah. I mean, when you're drinking sluice, like...
Yeah, it's gross. So Edwin died 2 months later, and Mercy's remains were buried after being desecrated.
Hmm.
So next story comes from 1927. A Haitian woman by the name of Anastasie Dudonné. I don't know. This is all French.
Mm-hmm.
I don't speak French. She confessed to the St. Petersburg Times. So she was Haitian, but as far as I can tell, St. Petersburg Times was a newspaper in Florida. So I guess she was living in Florida. So she confessed to the St. Petersburg Times that she repeatedly drugged her 9-year-old niece and drank her blood from an incision between the girl's toes, and that she did it because she had an uncontrollable urge to do so.
Uh-huh.
And that's that. That's that story. That's the entire thing.
I know. To drink the blood from between your toes.
Yes.
Gross.
The next one is called the Highgate Vampire. According to a report on November 2nd of 1968 in the London Evening News, on the night of Halloween 1968, a graveyard desecration by persons unknown occurred at Tottenham Park Cemetery in London. These persons arranged flowers taken from graves in circular patterns with arrows of blooms pointing to a new grave which was uncovered. A coffin was opened and the body inside disturbed. But their most macabre act was driving an iron stake in form of a cross through the lid and into the breast of the corpse.
Mm.
So that was a newspaper article. That's what it had said. A few months later, on February 6th, 1970, David Ferrant accounted that he had been walking past the cemetery on December 24th when he saw a gray figure that he figured was supernatural.
Ooh.
And then... in 1971, a young girl was passing the cemetery when she was attacked by a very tall, white-faced, dark figure that threw her to the ground so hard that she suffered from scrapes on her arms and legs. Luckily, the shadow figure immediately disappeared when a car pulled up to the scene. The girl, who was in a state of shock, was taken to the police station and eventually told her own story.
Ooh,
so that's
wow.
The Highgate Vampire.
I see.
Yes. So not... a lot of information on it, but some.
Hmm. It happened.
So,
according to somebody, it happened.
Yes. So, that's the last story I've got. But as far as explanations for what vampirism is or is caused by, there's a lot of possible explanations. One is improper knowledge of the stages of decomposition, especially for the older tales, you know, like the 1700s and 1800s. Not a lot was known about decomposition because it was kind of once you bury a body, you just leave it there, you know. Mm. So it was not a lot of people knew that, you know, when you die, your skin, hair, and nails immediately stop growing. But because of skin drying out and decomposition happening, the skin can actually pull back from the nails and hair follicles to make it appear like they've been growing. Same with like teeth and the gums.
Yep.
They dry up and they shrink back and it looks like things have been growing when in fact it's just decomposition. Also, bodies bloat.
Mm-hmm.
Fluids will flow out the nose and mouth. You know, that's just normal decomposition. Also, in the case of Mercy Brown, when she died, it was winter time, so they weren't able to bury her in the ground. So they buried her in an above ground like sepulcher until the spring when they could properly bury her. And with her being buried above ground in cold conditions, they think that it might have preserved her body a little bit better because it was, you know, an entire winter.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, they dug her up like a year later. So it was, she had technically less time to decompose. So that's kind of what they were thinking with her. Another explanation is premature burial. There are some cases where people had a disease that put them into a comatose state. And back before what a coma was, like back before comas were like
understood
and, properly. Yeah. Thank you. They would assume that they died, especially since like the heart rate can go down, breathing can become erratic, and signs of life can disappear without the aid of electronical medical equipment. So they would bury them prematurely and these people would wake up from their comas and be buried. And that would kind of help the vampire lore of dead coming back to life.
And that's actually what led to the creation of the, like, the grave bell. There would be a pipe that would lead down into your coffin and stuff, and a bell at the top just in case you were buried a little and, like, too
there
soon.
And there was, like, a string attached to it. Mm-hmm. So if you woke up in a coffin buried alive, you could ding the bell and it would, you know, would alert people, hey, I've been buried alive, come help me. Now, obviously, that didn't stick around very long, but that was a practice for a while.
Yeah.
Diseases, like I mentioned, were also contributed to or attributed to vampirism. Diseases such as tuberculosis, the bubonic plague, and even rabies. It's not very common for humans to contract rabies, but when they do, the symptoms can be very similar to signs of vampirism. Mental illness or psychopathology is also a contributing factor. People just, they have a mental illness that compels them to drink blood or do violent acts like that. That can be, I mean, there have even been modern day cases of people who had a mental illness that made them, you know, believe full-heartedly that they were vampires and that, you know, they had aversions to sunlight and things like that. Another more recent explanation that has been kind of disproven, this one came from, I think, 1985, was that it was porphyria, which is a group of diseases that build up in the infected person's body and affects the nervous system. This can cause a low amount of heme, which is a type of iron in the blood, and needs to be replenished intravenously. So, but this was kind of like disproven as a reason for vampirism. But the disorder can also cause a sensitivity to sunlight, you know, which could also be part of that mythology. But yeah, so those are all the explanations I have. That's all I've got on vampires as a cryptid. A lot of it was more just a history lesson, but
yeah, that's very cool.
I thought it was cool to talk about. So yeah. I hope you guys enjoyed that.
Yeah. In fact, actually, it was funny when you mentioned the Mary, Mary, and Mercy. I was like, this story sounds really familiar. Where have I heard this before? And if you guys want more information about the New England vampire scare panic, we actually did an episode in, I think, the first season. I did it as a conspiracy. So for more information about specifically in New England, you guys should go back and check that episode out.
Right.
But
yeah, you did talk about that.
I was like, why does this sound so familiar? But hey.
So,
I kicked it off saying I was going to step on your toes. So there you go.
Yeah.
We've talked about Mercy Brown twice on this podcast at this point. Once again, Mercy Brown. that was really cool. I didn't know about like that serial murderess, like with 650 young girls. Like, holy cow.
Yeah. Elizabeth Bathory. So like I said, I learned about her while I was in college. And the reason I did was because my friends and I all watched this really crappy B horror movie back then called Stay Alive. Mm-hmm. And it's about like a video game that kills you. And the video game was centered around the legend of Elizabeth Bathory. Mm-hmm. Although they changed it for the movie and made it take place in New Orleans, Louisiana versus Romania.
Because it kind of sounds like she's really like similar to Madame LaLaurie in New Orleans.
Kind of. Madame LaLaurie was also a very real person. She tortured and killed a lot of her slaves. Mm-hmm. And did very horrific things. I think it was American Horror Story Coven talked about her a lot. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much they got right in that and how much they fabricated, but yeah, she was a very real person.
Oh, yeah.
They used to give tours of her house, but they don't anymore. Mm-hmm. I just found that out. I wanted to go tour her house and learn the history, but apparently it is privately owned now. Like somebody lives there and they don't give tours anymore.
Oh, but you're a cheery person, I hope.
Right? I don't know who would want to live in the house of a, you know, serial killer like that, but you know, whatever floats your boat, different strokes for different folks.
Yeah. Well, speaking of serial killers, don't forget to check out our Halloween episode coming out on Halloween, and then we will have another our normally regularly scheduled programming the next night, so you guys get an extra episode this week or this month. And anything else we need to announce this summer?
I don't think so. I do want to like plug my own Instagram for a second. I've been doing a, like I plugged it on our Twitter, but I do also want to plug it on here. I have been, I created a 31 day Halloween challenge for myself. A lot of my friends do what's known as Inktober, where they're artists, you know, they draw like a different picture every day or paint a different picture, something like that for the month of October. I am very artistically challenged. You know, I can sew, I can do all sorts of cosplay stuff like that and music, but when it comes to art and drawing, I cannot do that. So I wanted to find a different way to participate in like a 31 day October Halloween challenge. So what I am doing is every day this month, I am creating or recreating a classic Goosebumps book cover, like in real life. So basically, like I am posing as these characters on the covers of these Goosebump books, and using
like,
I'm using my limited Photoshop abilities to edit some of them to look more like these pictures. But yeah, head over to my Instagram. That's at Sammy Simplicity. So that's SAMMY and then the word simplicity. And that's my Instagram. And you can check all those out. And then you can check out all of our social media, which is CryptiPod on everything.
Yes.
You know, CryptiPod. And you can find us there. But other than that, I have nothing to say.
That's awesome. Well, great. Cool. So. Yeah. I just finished an awesome book that you guys might actually be interested in. Go check out The Anomaly by Michael Rutger. Oh my God. I was glued to it for like 2 days. It's like Indiana Jones meets The Cave meets the Grand Canyon. I mean, it was just an amazing story. So please, guys, go read it because I got to talk to somebody about it. I already spoiled it for Ian because I got too excited. So he can't read it. And you guys need to go read it. So please give me somebody to talk to so we can chat about it.
What is it called?
It's called The Anomaly by Michael Rutger, R-U-T-G-E-R.
So it is available on Audible.
Oh, hey.
Just FYI. We do still have our Audible promotion running, though we don't really talk about it much anymore because I don't like to spam you guys with that because that's kind of like our only sponsor, so I don't want to run it every episode.
Exactly.
But if you go to audibletrial.com/CryptiPod, you can get a free audiobook download, and you could download The Anomaly by Michael Rutger.
So go listen to it, guys, and we can talk about it. So please, 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 please.
All right. I have nothing else. Yep. You have nothing else.
Good
Thank you
go.
All for listening. We hope you'll tune in for the 31st episode, but if not, we'll see you on November 1st. And without further ado,
don't forget
Big Brother is watching.
Thank you so much for joining us for another episode of Conspiracies and Cryptids with Sammy and Tessa. Don't forget to check out our website, www.conspiriesandcryptids.com, for more episodes and other information.
And if you're really enjoying what we're doing, check out our Patreon at patreon.com/CryptiPod. That's CryptiPod. There you can find different ways to support us and get some awesome goodies along the way.
While you're at it, you can also find us on all of your favorite social media platforms like Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. That's any one of those at CryptiPod.
And if you're enjoying our podcast, please think about leaving us a 5-star review on iTunes. Leave us 5 stars and a nice little blurb about why you like us. It helps us to gain some traction and find some new listeners.
And while you're at it, don't forget to tell your friends, because our friends are your friends.
And don't forget, Big Brother is watching.